Environmental Ethics Part 2 was presented by Charlie Dewberry on March 13, 2007 at McKinsey Study Center's Tuesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're here last week. Did any of you happen to bring your tables back from last night?
Oh, a couple.
All right. Okay. Well, let me know if I made enough copies for this week then. Whoops, I better keep one. Oh, and I see it cut off. Oh, here's some more. Here's some more. Okay. Hopefully this will be enough. And I see it cut off a little on the left. Okay. Well, last time, this is the second week of 2 weeks, so this is our last week, and I'm basically talking about man's relationship with land or environmental ethics. And last week, what I basically outlined my project here is I'm basically constructing three models. So here's kind of where I'm coming from. I spent half my life as a non-Christian. And issues with regards to management of land or man's relationship to nature have been always pretty central for me. They've always been things that were pretty high on my radar screen. And so for me, this issue actually was a major impediment to becoming a Christian. And for reasons that I think will be clear. So what I had started to do last week is, it seems to me in looking at man's relationship to land or environmental ethics, however you want to frame the question, as I look at it, there's really two perspectives that are taken. And as I said last week, I've experienced both of them quite a lot. So for example, I spend a lot of time working with non-Christians who are very interested in the environment. Many of them are radical environmentalists. So when they find out I'm a Christian, their immediate question is, how can I possibly be a Christian and do the kind of work I do? They're antithetical. From their perspective, Christians are basically right-wing Republicans who hold a free market view with regard to man's relationship with land. All they hear is that when it comes to the land, what we really need to do is back up and let free market supply and demand operate. That mechanism itself, if it's allowed to operate freely, will essentially meet all the requirements that we're supposed to meet. The litmus test for the free market model for me is I ask the question, what are the constraints with regards to the free market model? And the answer that I get invariably is basically let the free market model work. There are no other constraints that are usually given with regard to that model. And that's kind of the litmus test. If what comes back is just let the market work, that if you allow the market to work, it will function properly, and within that market, it will protect the valuable resources that we need. So that's the argument that's usually made there. On the other side, there's the environmental model. And as I pointed out last week, on the environmental side, there's kind of a wide range of responses, all the way from what we might call a conservation perspective to a real ultra environment, radical environmental view. I mean, some of the more radical views would say human beings ought to basically commit suicide because we're the parasite that's, you know, affecting and destroying the biosphere. So the real extreme radical environmentalists would go that far. So last week I basically talked about the first two models. I'll really briefly go through the two, and then I'll ask if there's any questions or things we want to talk about with regard to those two. My primary objective tonight is to go on then and develop what I think is a biblical model. The biblical model, I think, is different from either of the two models that I've basically put together at this point. Okay, the free market model. The ultimate good is material prosperity. The purpose of nature is to provide for man's material needs. That's basically how the free, in the free market model, that's the purpose of nature, is primarily, entirely to provide for our material needs. The immediate good is profit. The mechanism that decides what gets done is supply and demand, that if you just let the market forces work, it will, in fact, provide a mechanism to keep resources sustainable. The model of dominion is an absolute ruler. And what's man's responsibility? To maximize economic efficiency. And so in this model, is it necessary to protect all species? And the answer is obviously no. Now, I'm not necessarily saying any person or group, you know, holds exactly this perspective, but it's more or less a perspective that I think I've heard a major part of my life. That was actually one of the two dominant responses I think over the last 35 years I've heard. On the other side, the environmental model, and as I say, it's a little more diverse here, but the ultimate good for mankind is in general something like protecting the biosphere or protecting the sustainability of the Earth system. Something along those lines. Second, the purpose of nature. You'll get a wide variety of arguments here, but spiritual and material. The immediate good, then, is to protect the integrity of ecosystems. That's really, that's the immediate good. That's what needs to happen. The mechanism for management. The first mechanism for management is a moral or ethical, claiming that it's morally or ethically our duty to do it. But there's an immediate fallback that doesn't seem to be working anywhere. So just to keep things continuing, there's a move then that we need government regulation to ensure that basically the integrity of ecosystems are protected. In this model, the radical people would say there's no dominion. I mean, we're just another part of the system. So one answer would be there's no dominion at all. Others would argue that there is more of a dominion and it's more like a stewardship, that there is a stewardship sort of responsibility. But again, kind of a wide range with regard to the model of dominion. But I would say the predominant model of dominion in this view is that there is no dominion, that we're really just part of nature. So what's man's responsibility here? And the answer to that is protect the biosphere, protect this self-sustaining planet that provides the life forces, that provides the habitat for all life that exists on Earth. Is it necessary to protect all species? Almost all environmentalists would say yes, that protection of biodiversity is is a very important cornerstone of this view. So that's largely what I talked about last week. That's a quick overview of those sort of two models. And I think what we've seen in the last 20 to 50 years that I've been around is really just these two polarized groups arguing back and forth and virtually being in gridlock. And we've seen that expressed many times here in the Pacific Northwest over the last 20 years. I'll stop there and say questions or things we want to talk about, things from last week or people that weren't here. Any questions or anything about those two models? No? Okay. I'll move on then to now looking at a biblical model of essentially man's relationship to nature or environmental ethics, however you prefer to frame the topic here. What I'm going to start doing is, what I want to do first is, I'm going to go to the Bible to pull out just a few key principles here to begin. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to, for the purposes tonight, because I'll probably be lucky to get through this tonight, given our track record last week, I'm going to limit myself pretty much to the Pentateuch. So I'm only going to look at the Pentateuch to derive the principles. I think there's more than enough there for the task. But I'm primarily going to limit myself there, except for the very first thing I'm going to talk about, naturally, which is the ultimate good for mankind. So what I want to do first is I want to go and look at a few pieces from the Old Testament just as a place to take off from. Now, my intent here is not to do really intensive and for a number of folks, controversial exegesis. I want to go to passages and pull out what I think are general principles that most everyone would agree on. And I think even doing that will essentially provide enough of a foundation for me to put together the biblical model. So with that, the first place I will start is in Genesis, day 6. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." And God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created him. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fishes of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on earth." Then God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed. It shall be food for you. And to every beast of the earth and every bird of the sky and to everything that moves on earth which has life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. Genesis 1, 26 to 30. Okay. There's a few words and concepts here that I'd like to spend just a couple minutes going over and talking a little bit about, because these will begin to form some of the foundation of our model. The first one is the idea of our image, that man was created in God's image. This idea of in what sense is man created in God's image. This forms an important piece, it seems to me, because this is setting a context for how is it that human beings are like God. And it seems to me that the most obvious candidates are rational and moral aspects. So if it isn't those, then how? What else? What are other candidates here that we can lobby for that are possibilities of in what sense are we created in the image of God? I mean, it seems to me those are the two most likely candidates. And at this point, I'm not going to draw any further conclusions other than to say I think one or both of those aspects is what the verse has in mind. The next one is rule over. Well, this is obviously the concept of dominion. So very clearly here it's saying we have dominion over the natural world, but there's a great deal of ambiguity in what that means. What form does dominion take? What's its extent? And what else does it entail other than our having dominion over those? So at this point, all I want to draw from it is the fact that it is telling us that man was given dominion over nature. Exactly what that looks like will begin to get fleshed out as we go here through a number of verses. The next part, be fruitful and increase in number. So remember that at the beginning here, man is starting out as one and then two. So the be fruitful and increase here is basically starting with one and increasing. And that in God's created order, the idea that there's going to be many more human beings, that human beings are going to create increase on the planet, that's considered a good thing. And again, there's ambiguity here. What does that mean? How far do we take that? Then there's the issue of fill the earth. Okay, it's good for human beings to spread out across the whole earth. But again, there's a number of ambiguities here. Does it mean humans are to fill every square mile on the planet? Is that what it means to fill the earth? Is that what's demanded here? Or does the concept of fill, does that indicate that there's some kind of limit? I mean, if we fill a container, there's a limit. So is it a mandate to fill only so high and then no higher? Again, that's ambiguous here, it seems to me. So now we come to one of the key concepts, the notion of subdue the earth. And actually, this was one of my stumbling blocks for quite a while. And I'll comment that to me, it's only the work of the Spirit, in a sense, that changed my perception on this when I saw what it meant. Well, when I read it and interpreted it in a straightforward sense here. But the word subdue, I don't have the vowel points on it, but I think the word is rheda. Anyway, I believe the word is rheda. But as I say, I'm not sure what the vowels are here. I didn't get that on my printout. But literally, if you look what that word means, it means to stomp. So to subdue it means to stomp. Well, naturally, when I found that, that was a major impediment. And I used it many times as ammunition against a Christian view. And over a number of years, no one corrected me. But somewhere along the line, I realized that the way the word's used is usually stomp, as in stomp grapes to make wine. So what it's saying is, seems to me, is human beings are to work and to transform nature. And so we're to transform it to yield a useful product, even in this case. So, as I say, a number of places, the most common use is to stomp grapes to make wine. So suddenly now it was a more benign picture at best, one that wasn't, you know, just you have dominion over, you can do whatever you want and just stomp it into the ground. Now it's more of a picture of man essentially taking the elements of nature and transforming them into a useful product. That's a very different picture. And it seems to me that that's more of the sense that's intended by the Genesis passage here. So, that's the picture we get from Genesis 1. The second piece I'd like to go to next is the fall. And notice the effects of the fall. Cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and dust you shall return. Well, it seems to me the fall is basically telling us that man's relationship to nature has been fundamentally transformed here at the fall. So now, and one of the major effects of the fall is that our relationship to nature is an integral part of the fall. So because of it, the ground is cursed. And it indicates that thorns and thistles, in other words, plants that grow, we'd call them weeds, that have no productive benefit for us, are now going to make life a lot harder. So with regards to nature, we're now put in a situation where it's going to be very difficult. We're going to have to work much harder just to gain the materials that we need to sustain ourselves here. So, and one of the implications here is that a number of plants that are now here are here for the express purpose of thwarting our efforts, and most of us know many of them well. We've spent a portion of our lives dealing with them, so I think it's a concept we all know pretty well. Okay. Now I'd like to move to Leviticus 19, 9 to 10. And basically, this verse is basically claiming that one of the rules here in Leviticus is God proclaims that man must not harvest to the corner of their fields nor glean their vineyards. Now, what is this about? I mean, why shouldn't we essentially clear our land all the way into the corners? Why shouldn't we make every piece of the land productive? What's at stake here? And so the whole verse basically says, now when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, neither shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, nor shall you glean your vineyards, nor shall you gather fallen fruit from your vineyards. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God. So what it's saying is that, the first obvious thing it seems to me to be drawn here is the idea of economic efficiency is not the highest good here. And this seems actually quite contrary to the way we would approach this kind of problem. And that is, well, look, if you want to provide food for the needy and the strangers, what better way would there be to do it than basically farm your entire piece of property and then just give them the extra stuff? I mean, if that's the issue, then that would be the most efficient way to do it. And I think that would be the way we would approach it. So it seems to me that there's something else at stake here. And as we go on, in another couple verses, I think it will become a little more clear what those things are. But I would suggest that basically part of this is to just recognize that you are essentially producing the fruits of your labor, and you gather those, but yet you're leaving essentially an amount of them out there, and basically that's up to God what happens to those. I mean, it's a way in which it seems to me at minimum that we would participate in something that God may be doing. But as I say, the command itself, it seems to me as I look at it, that isn't the way we would approach this kind of a problem. So it's suggesting to me that there's something else kind of at stake. The next one that I'd like to talk about is in Deuteronomy, that God establishes a law with regard to collecting wildlife for food. If you happen upon a bird's nest along the way, in a tree or on the ground, with young ones or eggs, and the mother sitting on the young or eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall certainly let the mother go. But the young you may take for yourself in order that it may be well with you and that you prolong your days. Again, we could read this as that we can take the young in order that we're fed so that it goes well with us and that it prolongs our days. But if it's just for us and prolonging our days and so it goes well with us, why is it that we can't take the mother? And so again, it's suggesting that there's a different principle here at stake. So very clearly here, it seems to me, that it's saying that, well, yes, the wildlife is here food for us, yes. But there's also another issue involved with regard to the mother. Why can't we take the mother? Why are we only allowed to take the young? And again, this is the same sort of question, it seems to me, that came up with the crops the first time. Well, why can't we take all the crops? And it seems to me now that we have this verse, it's one of the principles that we should draw from this is both the crops and the wildlife. In a sense, neither one of those belong to us. Those are God's. And so, in fact, not taking them all is just a small reminder, it seems to me, at minimum, that they're not ours, that they are not all ours for our benefit, that there's something else at stake. The next verse I'd like to examine is Deuteronomy 25, where God commands you shall not muzzle the ox while he's threshing.
What was the one before that, Deuteronomy?
Oh, Deuteronomy 22, 6 and 7. Here in Deuteronomy 25, 4, God commands that you shall not muzzle the ox while he's threshing. And again, this seems related in a sense to the other two in that here again, what we're seeing is like the best economic efficiency or the best economic use is not the highest use. I mean, we have seen this in all three cases. And so, again, as I say, the minimum kind of conclusion that we should draw from this is, at minimum, something other than economic efficiency is important. That there's a higher principle than that at stake here. Okay. The next one, Deuteronomy 20, 19 and 20. When you besiege a city a long time to make war against it in order to capture it, you shall not destroy its trees by swinging an axe against them, for you may eat from them, and you shall not cut them down. For is the tree of the field a man, that it should be besieged by you? Only the trees which you know are not fruit trees shall be destroyed, or shall you destroy and cut down. You may construct siege works against the city to make war with you until it falls. Well, here, this seems like a very strange kind of a law. I mean, in war, siege, you can't cut down a fruit tree? I mean, you can cut down other kind of trees and other kind of wood to provide you with basically the material for your siege, to knock down the walls as part of your siege. But again, what is the issue here with a fruit tree? And it seems to me, again, that we're, again, seeing a picture that, well, obviously something else is at stake here. And it seems to me a couple principles, again, related to the other two, is at first, those fruit trees are God's, not ours. And even in the case of where we're sieging, we don't have absolute dominion or the right here to destroy all trees and all materials here. There's a prohibition. And notice that it is fruit trees, productive to provide people with food. So again, there's a principle, it seems, a set of principles here to be drawn. The last place I'm going to go is Leviticus 25, the sabbatical year and year of Jubilee. And I'm only going to read an excerpt of this. It's rather longer, but I don't want to take the time to read the whole piece, but enough of it to again begin to fit some of the pieces together. So 6 years you shall sow your fields, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyards and gather its crops. But during the seventh year the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. Your harvests after growth you shall not reap. Your grapes of untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year, and all of you shall have the Sabbath products of the land for food. And then I'm skipping just a little bit. You shall have the 50th year as a jubilee. You shall not sow nor reap its aftergrowth nor gather in from its untrimmed vines, for it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat its crops out of the field. And then skipping a couple more. The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. For you are but aliens and sojourners with me. Leviticus, I ended at 25:23. Okay, well, what do we make out of the Sabbath and the Jubilee here? And it seems to me that one of the principles certainly to draw from this is the principle that the land doesn't belong to man. That's part and parcel what the Jubilee is about, for man to recognize that the land doesn't belong to him, it belongs to God, and that man is but an alien and a sojourner. And so during the years of the Sabbath and the Jubilee, God will provide for man's needs without the labor of man involved. So, but as I say, the primary principle, it seems to me, to draw from the Jubilee, and there's a lot you can talk about and think about with regard to the Jubilee, but it seems to me that both, that its point is to remind us of what our relationship is here to nature and what our relationship to God and to the rest of the creation is here. And so when you put these sort of pieces together, it seems to me then that we're in a position to basically then begin to build our biblical model. And as I say, I'll stop for a minute. As I say, I've pulled in a number of verses, and I've tried to draw what I think the most basic, obvious principles from those verses are. And I'll stop, and we can talk about those. If there's any pieces you want to talk about with regard to those, yes.
It seems like when you got to the point where talking about the fruit trees and saying that, you know, the land is mine and you're just temporary residents, basically, that it seems to me that God is saying, okay, it's almost like a child-parent relationship. It's like, this is mine, but I want you to use it to your benefit, but I have to set some guidelines and rules for you so you don't basically harm yourself or others. Because, like, one of the aspects, like I was thinking with the gleaning, like with Ruth, I mean, this is one way that the poor actually fed themselves. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's a very dignified way that you are giving something, them an opportunity to work, to provide for themselves instead of just giving to them. So it's a kind of dignity, when also the nature, which obviously the corners, the gleaners, aren't going to touch. So this, I think, is a dual principle. It's like, one, this is my land, but I'm setting aside these principles so that you won't be destructive, that you will actually keep the land going. And by looking at these principles, it seems like very sound environmental principles. I mean, you don't kill the mother when you come across her nest because she can produce more eggs. Whereas you kill the mother, she can't produce any more eggs. So you're essentially cutting off that production line.
Okay. Well, thank you. I didn't really hear a question there exactly. Yeah. But
Well, basically, I want to say, is this kind of what you get from that?
Well, give me a few minutes. Give me a few minutes to kind of develop the model then and interact with this model as in comparison to the other two. Okay. Any other specific comments at this point? Okay. Well, sure.
So let me see if I got this right. The two principles that I heard is it's not a biblical value to maximize efficiency, mm-hmm. and the land doesn't belong to you, it belongs to God.
The two explicitly articulated ones are that at this point, okay. Although we're going to come back again and talk a little bit more about the connection and how we can put all of those verses together. But right now, those are the two I want to start with. Okay, so, all right, so now I'll answer the same questions that I did for the other two models. So what I'll do first is go through the biblical model, and as I go, I will just point out the differences with regard to that characteristic from the other two models, and then at the end, I'll kind of summarize what I think the differences in the biblical model are from the other two, and then we'll see where we are at that point. Okay, the biblical model. First, the ultimate good for mankind. And this part I'm drawing from outside the Pentateuch, but it's the idea of Paul's concept of life. And, you know, life is something we don't know very much about. As Paul tells us, you know, life in this age is characterized by death, sort of moral entropy, is that relationships, lots of things start out with a great potential, and then over time, things just don't continue to maintain and strive and become that potential. Something happens. There's just, you have to work very, very hard to maintain that the point where you started, the beginning, that had all the promise. And so we're very familiar with death in that sort of sense. But what Paul's painting is a picture of life. Imagine where the natural tendency of your own life, of your relationships, of your relationship to land and nature. Imagine where you didn't have to work very hard at it and it just got better. As I say, it's not a picture that we know a lot about, but it's a picture that we hope for. The purpose of nature then. Well, first we saw from the verses it is to provide for man's material needs, but also with the fall and with those other other laws and things, it's really providing us for a context to work out our faith. In other words, it seems to me that one of the things that those verses are saying, this is part of the context of your life experience to work out your faith, that this is just one more part of your life that isn't any different from the other parts. And I think that that's a major piece of what the connected verses and things were pointing at. Third, the immediate good is first faith, as well as our material good. So what I'm implying here is that there is a good involved, and with regard to the purpose we just saw, there are things that we ought to do. In other words, there are moral things that are incumbent upon us to do. Fourth, the mechanism for management, I would argue, it's moral. That the whole issue is, in part, making moral decisions and working out your faith. That ultimately, making moral decisions is the mechanism by which we manage the resources that are provided here on the earth. The model of dominion is a steward. By that, you do have a dominion of sorts, but there's an equal recognition with that there's responsibilities. What's man's responsibility? To meet his material needs and to make morally right decisions with regard to these resources that we have, or at least work out what it means to make moral decisions with regard to those, to nature, natural resources. And lastly, is it necessary to protect all species? I would argue no in this model. I mean, at the fall, we saw that there's a number of plants put there with the explicit purpose of making life hard. Are we to maintain those? I don't think we're mandated to maintain those. So I'll stop for just a second and then make my comparison with the other two models. Questions? Yes.
It's not a disagreement. It's just a desire to flesh this out in two and three.
Okay.
Man to work out faith, and then three, faith. Now, can you flesh that out a little more from these scriptures that you gave us to talk about faith?
Okay. Well, as I look at those verses and then what it appears to me that God's doing with those with those with Deuteronomy of giving them sort of a laundry list of do's and don'ts here. I mean, it seems to me that what God is providing with them is two things. One is he's telling them basically what moral conduct he is expecting of them, that essentially what the moral principles are. But he's also, for them, giving them a cultural set of principles, because he's designating them as his people, and they're to have a characteristic cultural component. So whenever we look at these kinds of verses here, it seems to me we need to look at the verses carefully and make sure whether they're just prescribing something cultural for them, like, oh, help me, let me see if I can come up with one quick. Oh, sure. I mean, yeah, there's just a number of them that are pretty clearly not moral issues, but something else is going on, and I think it's just a prescription of a religion so that it's evident to themselves and other people that they're a culture, that they're God's culture. So it's making them distinctive. Okay, well, in these moral principles, we see that how the Jews use them as we look at the Old Testament is they tended to look at them as individual tasks, and that living a good life and right life was just checking them off one at a time, making sure they did each one of them independently. And it seems to me that as we see the Bible unfold, that's sort of a misunderstanding of what function they are to have. And what function it seems to me they're to have is, yes, they are items that you are supposed to do. But human beings, our natural propensity is to draw those kinds of things into some kind of a coherent whole. And it seems to me they were to take those kinds of things and think about them and basically draw the principles that are explicitly important for their particular situation. So it isn't that they're just a laundry list and this is the only laundry list. It seems to me that the purpose was in part to, yes, outline what it would look like in a particular situation, but it's not covering all situations, and it was intended for them to begin to put it together. So with that now is where I want to come back and say, well, look, I think that when we look at those verses, the first one started out with the gleaning, that, yes, in part what you said is a part of what was going on, meaning that for the poor, it was better for them to go glean themselves than to have somebody just hand them the stuff. But it seems to me there was also tied to the larger principle that there are values here beyond just your economic needs. So it's not just an issue of economic efficiency, but there are concerns about other people. And then we saw the wildlife example, so it's not just other people, but there's also a concern for wildlife as well. Also for domestic animals, that there's a set of expectations that they would actually, that it's morally right and a moral imperative that they ought to care for these things. So for me, as I look at just those few verses, it seems to me that what we see is we see all of them are pointing at the same sort of picture of the fact that the natural world isn't ours to do with it as we want, but it's here, and it's actually part of what we interact with to work out our faith, and it's part of what we are provided with. It's what provides our material well-being, as well. So that's an important aspect of life. But again, as I say, it just fits with the rest of life, that this is just, as I say, one more element where in obtaining our material needs here, in interacting with that, we're bumping up against moral imperatives. We're bumping up against we're bumping up against moral decisions that, as we make them right or we not make them right, and all of that, that's part of what is part of the dynamics of our working out our faith. Okay.
When I saw your table here and I saw the biblical model's answer to number 7, is it necessary to protect all species? I was really curious to see what you were going to say about that, because I think a person that was in your position early on that cared deeply about the environment and had a stereotypical view of the Christian response, if they were to see that answer in that column, they'd go, well, yeah, see, I was right. They don't care. And I'm glad you qualified it with the notion that having the understanding of reality that we do, that involves a creator and moral agents and a fall and a curse, and all of that implies means that, yeah, there are noroviruses and there are bindweed and there are things that wouldn't necessarily. I guess I'm struggling with how to define a model that would say it is preferable to protect all species, with the understanding that there are species that are part of the curse, let's say, that they are destructive, that they are worthy of being destroyed. And then you have starlings and house sparrows and English sparrows.
Hey, well.
Yeah, I know. Okay. When I was working for Parks and Open Space, we were batting around a mission statement or something that, or maybe a motto would be a better word. And it was like, every species in its place.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, send the starlings back to back to England. And
so, right.
Okay, I've rambled on, but I was really interested in your qualification for the no answer for number 7. That, I thought that was very interesting.
Well, thank you. Well, since you started with that one, I'll now make some comments about the comparison with the other two models. Well, it's in agreement with the free market model that it isn't necessary to save all the species, but I think in a very different way. In the free market model, there really is no imperative to preserve any species. There isn't an imperative to protect any species. And in part, just a comment, I'm not aware of a single instance of a species in what's called the commons, so be it a marine fish or something out, that basically, well, there was a study that came out a few years ago that there's 93 of the most productive fishery species in the world's oceans that have provided food for human beings over the centuries. All 93 of them are on the verge of extinction, probably within the next 50 years. So there are virtually none of the main 93 species that can be harvested at anywhere near the levels they could have been harvested 10 or 20 years ago. They're 4 and 5% of what they were. And one of the most classic examples of that is the Grand Banks off Newfoundland. I mean, it was the most productive cod fishery in the world, and it provided Europe with their cod every Friday for their fish for Friday for 1,000 years. And basically, they're not allowed to fish the majority at all of the Grand Banks. That fishery is virtually closed. We're not getting any cod from that fishery any longer. So, again, I'm not aware of any species economically viable. And in this region, salmon would be the obvious candidate. There isn't one where a free market model running on the mechanism of supply and demand has basically managed them sustainably. So even the most economically viable ones, I don't see a mechanism in the model even to protect those. So as you pointed out, the environmental model says yes, and I would have been inclined that direction, although I never was completely in that category. I made my life working on a farm, and you know, there's certain species that, yeah, there were certain species that I wasn't about to preserve or protect anywhere. But, I mean, all we have to do is back up and think about what this claim really is. And, I mean, even here in Eugene, you don't see anybody clamoring to protect the AIDS virus. I mean, no one is protecting all life forms. I mean, no one believes that, in spite of the rhetoric. So but then again, I am sympathetic to the direction they go, because it seems to me that, although in answering no, that I think there are a number of species that we are rightfully trying to eradicate. Anopheles, mosquitoes that carry diseases that are impacting major cultures in Africa, all kinds of plants and animals, disease organisms, sure. But yet, on the other hand, and this is the piece I've really never heard from a Christian perspective, and that is, well, we're not mandated to protect all species, but actually the decisions we make and the impact we had, for example, of species going extinct, that we are culpable for that. We are culpable for our specific actions with regards to those particular critters. So on one hand, it seems to me there is a culpability, and there is a culpability that we need to address. There is an ought here. There is a moral imperative. There is a moral law. And so it seems to me that that's not a message, that that's a distinctive here between the free market model and the biblical model that I've never heard. So anyway, that's one of the places that it seems to me there should be a distinctly Christian answer as opposed to what I would call the free market model, that there is a culpability. That there is a responsibility for our actions that we will be held accountable for. Okay, so now let me make just some general comments about where the biblical model fits here with the other two. As I said last time, on one hand, we have the free market model, and as I have constructed this model, and again, as I say, it's one I've heard in general, but I'm not attributing it to any particular individual. But it basically, as I say, it's an economic model, and it's only an economic model. And as such, it doesn't recognize any moral principles outside of the economic model. And so in that sense, I called it last week pagan-like, that essentially it's not a moral picture at all by itself. On the other hand, the environmental model, well, let me say, but with regard to the free market model, it's right in that a major part of nature is to provide us with material prosperity. Two things about that is, one, as I say, material prosperity and economic efficiency are not the highest principles. That those two things are not biblical. The environmental model, on the other hand, I think most of the environmental model, as broadly as I've painted it here, they are right in recognizing that there is moral oughts, that there are moral issues with regards to nature and land. They are very right. So they're correct in their opposition to a free market model of pointing out that that isn't a moral model at all. So they're correct in that. However, they have a real problem in how they're going to ground their oughts. For instance, why is it that man is culpable here? If man's just part of this system, whatever man does is natural, right? I mean, how can you object? And I can't remember if I did mention this last week, that, you know, imagine an organism that all of a sudden started producing a toxic substance that was killing virtually all life forms. What would you say about that? Well, I mean, it happened in the past when an algae started to produce this toxic substance, oxygen, and killed off all the life forms that were then present. What do we say about that? According to the current model built on a Darwinian view, well, that's just the natural process. Well, what's different with man? Why are you making a distinction here between man and that algocell? On what basis are you claiming there's moral culpability here? It seems to me that's a problem. Secondly, there's a real tendency to make nature itself God. And there is a worship here of wilderness. So that when we go back and look at that Genesis passage and think about it, I mean, there is a place for wild places, it seems to me. But it also seems to me is that they do have their place and they are important. And but by the same token, they're not the standard by which we measure everything else by. So most environmentalists, if you ask them what are the most beautiful pieces of real estate, you know, and ask them to paint them or give you a picture of them, they're basically going to be uninhabited areas somewhere, you know, Alaska, BC, the Arctic somewhere, with no human beings. It seems to me that a biblical picture would say, well, yeah, those are neat, but equally neat are those parts of the landscape where human beings are carving out a life for themselves, wrestling and trying to work out their faith and get their material sustenance from that. That would be equally a beautiful picture, and in some ways more beautiful. That seems to be missing from many of the environmental pictures. One other element that seems to be quite different between these models is that in the free market economic model, it basically doesn't have, I'm not aware that there really is a picture of the future or a sense of history. It's basically just supply and demand. Some would call it cyclical. Some would call it kind of linear with bumps. But it doesn't really have a goal. In the environmental model, as they look at the trajectory of nature, they either see, on one hand, they'll see cycles, just a cyclical view of nature, or they'll basically see, you know, kind of a straight line, that basically the status quo is, or some static status quo at some point is essentially that's what it ought to be. So you either see them say over the long haul it's cyclical, or that there's some point that they point at and say, now this is how it ought to be. Now, it seems to me in the biblical model that neither one of those pictures is a very good view of history. And this was one of the more problematic places for me at points to begin to work out as well. As I mentioned last week, one of the places that when I got to it, I recognized that this was a fundamental shift. And basically that was the recognition that, that look, the environment's just part of our working out our faith. And if we can actually succeed at this, if we can actually do it right, if we can actually protect the species we ought to protect, if we ought to live lives that we ought to live, if we do all of those things, we ought to succeed. And it was like, well, if that's true, then the gospel is a lie. Because if it really is possible for us to do the law, then what in fact is the Christian message all about? So in the environmental model, there's a number of people that either claim they're near perfect or are perfect at living it out. Like the Pharisees, they defined it in a way that they could do that. What's that?
Carbon
neutral. Yeah, carbon neutral. So it seems to me that in the biblical model, though, there's a recognition that in this life, we're not going to succeed. I think a natural consequence of that is, over the long haul, that the perspective of what the natural world is going to look like is not positive. That at some point down the line, and who knows, and I'm not even going to go there at all or try. I don't have any idea what the picture is. But it seems to me until that day that the prognosis for the natural world is not incredibly rosy. But it seems to me that coming to grips with that has been one of the most miraculous parts of my transformation, because recognizing that that is in fact reality and that I'm part of that reality and I'm part of the problem is essentially the foundation of faith. And so, as I say, it seems to me a recognition that as history unfolds here, we're going to see increasing human sin and its effects in the natural world. And that's just going to be the reality of what unfolds. And as I say, that's, again, one of those points where we don't know what God is doing, but we can only trust that in the last chapter, in looking back at it, that this was a good story. So I think a frank perspective on the trajectory of nature here from a biblical perspective is not a real rosy picture. But in saying that, there's no less of a reason or no less of a mandate to strive to do the right things wherever we find ourselves. And that's our responsibility. And for those decisions, we're culpable. For the actual extinction of something out here, we may or may not have culpability in it. But it seems to me that our culpability is the decisions we actually make and on what foundation we make them. So I'll stop at this point and throw it open for questions.
So, Charlie, is that what you mean by working out your faith, is striving to do the right thing with respect to the environment? Is that what you mean?
Well,
what you mean by
Well, that's a piece of it, yes. Striving and working out our faith covers all aspects of life, not just nature. But all I'm saying is that with regard to the natural part, it's just like the striving and working that out, like we do the rest of our faith, our interaction with other people, our interaction with ourselves with regards to what we know is right to do that we don't do. Is that answering your question?
Yeah. But that in of itself doesn't answer the question of what our responsibility is. So I assume that's in your stewardship.
Yeah, that's in the stewardship model. And in part, I mean, it's hard to say specifics about that because it seems to me we each have a different calling and that impacts this as well. So that, you know, we each have a different role. And so it's going to be hard to set up a set of specific, you know, prescriptions or whatever else. So that's why I describe it as working out our individual faiths, because, I mean, I don't think this is something we can necessarily write the list for. You know, I mean, and that's not what working out your faith and growing in wisdom is about. You know, it's about learning what those principles are and learning really what's right instead of just doing a bunch of prescriptions. Like, see, that's the tie back to those Old Testament mandates or laws, is that for them, at that point, they were just individual laws. But as I say, for us, it seems to me you basically put them into a picture, into a whole picture of what our moral responsibility is. So I couldn't sort of really begin to outline specifics. That would be very difficult to do. Yes. Oh, forgot the mic.
Well, just one quick thing, if I can use something Jack brought up, which, like, talking about the Good Samaritan, like one point that you brought out, that although they were following the specifics of the law and not violating the Sabbath, they were not observing the nature of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can kind of apply that to the laws you were talking about from the Old Testament, that they looked at it as a list, but there's an kind of an overall concept.
Mm-hmm. So your point is that If I'm following you, your point is that the law says, love your neighbor. The issue you're raising is, who is my neighbor? Is that kind of where you were going with that? Or
what I want to bring out is that the laws are meant to direct our, quote, individual actions, but to give us a principle that we are to follow. In other words, like from these laws, like the gleaning laws, the not cutting down fruit trees, not killing the mother when you find the eggs, there's an overall concept that's involved in that, not mm-hmm. individually just. In other words, you are considerate about what your actions are in nature. In other words, the actions that you take, you don't want to take actions that are going to harm nature to the point where it's harmful to someone else. In other words, like you could almost apply with the mother with the eggs. Okay, you take, or the young, you take the young, but the mother is still there. Mm-hmm. And so potentially next year, someone else could take those eggs. Or you can look at it in nature. The mother is able to produce more eggs, so you're keeping the system going and helping provide for the person that comes after you. I mean, I like the term that some of the environmentalists use, is like we all live downstream mm-hmm. from someone. And then something else I want to bring up, kind of, I guess you'd say a devil's advocate. I would say the market people would say, well, we are interested in preserving some species, albeit it is selfish. in that, you know, there's certain species of animals for meat production, different type of production, that they're very interested in keeping those types of species going, but it does fall in the model of what species are the most productive, i.e. the most money makers, but they are interested in preserving some species.
Okay, is...
Well, I see this as kind of one thing that if you were to come to market people and say, you know, you're not interested in preserving any species, they could come back and say, well, yes, we are.
Well, they could come back and say they are, but as I say, I would be interested in them presenting me with some examples of where they've actually been successful over a longer term of providing those. But actually, I would like to interact with the first part you said about your perspective of having the principles and basically obedience of those principles and things that's how, you know, we would make decisions about whether or not we leave. And, I mean, I think that's right, and all that's good and right in that. But it seems to me that for a number of people in a number of instances, the situations they find themselves are going to be far more problematic than that simple problem or that simple solution of trying to pick what's right and wrong. I mean, you know, envision yourself in a position where you have a family of five on the verge of starvation. You run into a bird with young. I mean, see, the point is here, there's a whole set of hierarchies, and it can come to a point where it's not just a simple calculus of figuring out what the right thing to do is. And it seems to me that for a number of people, that you're put in a position where you have to make the best of a bad set of decisions. And it seems to me that we have to recognize that within this dynamic picture, that's also a piece that needs to be in the dynamic picture. Anyway, just to add on to...
Well, how I would answer that is, like, I think God considers the life of that person more important than the bird.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Well, right. But I mean, all I was saying is there are lots of points where it's not just a simple calculus of even just looking at the principle and saying, here or here. And, you know, it's not going to be the same for each individual as they approach particular situations. You know, there may be a number of competing principles. So anyway, I just wanted to highlight that at times, that's why it's hard to, that's why it, again, why it's hard to begin to state, well, here's what it looks like and here's not. I mean, it seems to me that making decisions in this as well as other arenas in life also entails sometimes making hard decisions about competing principles.
Well, I can think of many examples that would agree with you.
So...
I was about what Jack was asking about too. I think partly, I mean, you can't prescribe what we should all care about as far as the environment goes. I mean, what is the Christian thing to do in every situation, or even what particular people should do because they have calling. But wouldn't you say, given the principles that you talked about, that it is incumbent on Christians to care? I mean, to care about the environment and to at least make it a consideration when they're making decisions. You know, they might let a species go, but to mm-hmm. at least to realize what they're doing and mm-hmm. to care about the environment
mm-hmm.
anyway, and not to just, because I think there are some, well, you know, even Christians that have that, mm-hmm. perhaps what you call the free market model, that basically don't care, don't see themselves as stewards of the environment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
At least if you could say that.
Right, yeah. No, that's right. I think that's, for me, the one piece that I could say should be universal among Christians is that at least it's an issue that, or at least it's a factor that's considered at times when certain actions are done. If I had more time, I was going to read a piece, Aldo Leopold, that I read last week. He wrote a short little essay that's called Monument to a Pigeon. And there's a monument for passenger pigeons. Where his farm was in Wisconsin, there were probably 150 million passenger pigeons within 50 miles of his cabin in 1870. And in 1899, the last one was shot. And so they basically constructed this big monument of a passenger pigeon, and he wrote this essay called, you know, Monument to a Pigeon. And you all should read it if it's of interest to you. It's in the Sand County Almanac. But basically his point is that he started out saying that they were here they were here basically for the funeral of the species. And that what had killed them was basically the clearing of the forests for agriculture. And the passenger pigeon just lived on the abundance of the land. And if they couldn't find food one day in Minnesota, they'd be in Michigan the next, in Tennessee a few days later. What happened was, with the settlement, they just basically transformed the forest, its fuel, its food, into ag land, and the pigeon basically disappeared. It just ran out of fuel. And anyway, it's a very interesting essay because he points out that in it he makes the point that the distinction between us and the pigeons was that the pigeons wouldn't have mourned our loss at all if it would have been us. But his point is what makes human beings distinctive is, in fact, that we could mourn their passing. And anyway, I think that was very insightful point. So, yeah, other questions or things? Yes.
Well, thank you so much for these talks. I've tended to be a utopian, and becoming a Christian and knowing that things are going to get really bad, and one of my major prayer topics has been, okay, Lord, you may be kind of a utopian. What do I do with it now? And so now I'm piecing together with what you've shared. It's that what is really at stake here, just reflecting back the idea, is that our acting in faith and doing the right thing regardless of the consequences. And I'm seeing kind of parallels with the prophet Jeremiah going his message the people, when God told them ahead of time, nobody's going to hear you. It won't make any difference, but I still want you to do what you need to do. So, thanks.
I was curious. I have a parallel in mind that I was wondering what your thoughts about were. And the parallel is that as I get older, and though outwardly we are wasting away, and yet we talk the rolling up of the tent that will come, and yet I have an imperative to maintain myself within certain limits. And I view the earth that way, that Peter says it's reserved for fire, but how then should we behave? And so I run those two parallel in my mind a lot of times, being certainly in the conservation camp in many ways. So I was wondering what your thoughts about that were, if that made sense to you or if it didn't hold water.
Well, tell me a little more about it. I'm not sure that I'm following the parallel.
That the planet has a life, mm-hmm. and a lifetime and an expectancy, and that it's going to end, mm-hmm. just as this flesh is going to end. And yet it doesn't take away the imperative that we're to be respectful, we're to take care of, and that we're, it's the outworking of my faith, it's the outworking of our faith that we have this place to be.
Okay. I guess I see that that's fine. I don't think I have any real difficulties with that. Yeah, I think that's a reasonable perspective. As I say, in my own case, I would describe it just a little, maybe a little bit differently, but I think it's similar, and that is, I mean, even given that this is probably the Titanic, there's still reasons to do, you know, the right things on it. But that's what I'm responsible for. And in my actions, I mean, hopefully if I actually do something that's good, it will manifest itself in benefits. But it's not that those benefits, you know, are necessarily what it's about. I mean, it's a moral imperative for me to do it, whatever the consequences or whatever comes out of that. But there are those places where good acts are actually done, and for some small places and for some period of time, you know, good things happen. So, I mean, it's a long trajectory with a lot of ups and downs. And so it seems to me there's an awful lot of room for good acts, that is, things that are done for the right reason. That when those things are done, there often is, you know, basically consequences that you can see that you just see it's a different trajectory, at least for a period of time at a particular place. And those are worthwhile. So I guess as I've gotten older, my goals have gotten smaller and on much smaller scale. So, you know, they used to be pretty big and grandiose, and now they're getting down fairly small and limited. But nonetheless, it seems to me they're still, you know, reasonable goals. And I don't know, that's just maybe getting older or something, but that's my experience with it, that there are those moments in small areas where you do see things change in a positive direction for a while. And that's neat. So, anything else? We're beginning to, yes?
I know it's late, but just briefly, do you see in the covenant God made with Noah, he refers multiple times to every creeping thing, every flesh on the earth. Mm-hmm. Do you think we can take any cues from that as to how what our response should be to all flesh on earth? Or do you think that's a bad theology?
Where is it that you're thinking that might go? I mean, I know the verses. How? What really is the question, or what do you see the parallel between the two?
Well, I'm wondering if there are some who would say that a biblical response would be for man to have dominion, mm-hmm. In opposition to some of the things you're saying. I wonder if this would be a reasonable reading, that God seems to be making a covenant with all flesh, including animals, not just man.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I would not be inclined to go that way, but I'm not prepared right now to go through. I'm not prepared to give you a defense of that, but I'd not be inclined to go that direction. But I'm not prepared to give you a good answer why either. All right. Well, thanks for coming.